First, let me reassure you that I won't go over time today because I got to get your plane, and I haven't found them to be as impatient, the planes, as Presbyterian laymen are out in Colorado. I suppose there are two ways to plan a talk or to deal with the problem. Sometimes you get a remedy, and medicine's whole history is filled with stories of somebody got a remedy that was the right remedy for a particular thing, and boy, it became the cure-all for almost everything. I remember when I was in medical school, they had discovered that some cases of arthritis and neuritis and various kinds of pains were due to infections in the sinuses and at the root of infected teeth or in the tonsils. And so that was the answer, and my, the people that lost their teeth and tonsils and had their sinuses drained, because this was the answer to almost anybody that came in with any kind of vague pain. Begin with a remedy first. Sometimes you hear a minister begin with a text, and then he looks around for something to apply it to. There's another way. That's to examine the patient, and then look around and see if you can find a remedy for what this patient's got. That's what we tried to do yesterday in some extent. And perhaps that's a way to plan a talk, too. What's the problem we face? Where is the text? Where is the answer in the scriptures or in the writings of those who've gone before that will be the answer to our particular problem? Now, I was trained, of course, to follow the second course. We talked yesterday about the sick world we've been dealing with, the one we're in. And I said there were two main words I thought, conflicts and confusion. Confusion. What can we believe about such a divided and confused world? What are we to believe? Some say there's nothing one can believe in today's cynical world. But of course, his own words contradict him, because obviously he believes something. He believes that there is nothing one can believe. He's got a faith. There isn't anything one can believe. Everyone has to believe something. Everyone does believe something. As the pastor said last night, everybody follows or obeys something. But ideas that you believe, convictions, insights, concepts, attitudes, these all come from men's minds. Their thoughts, their experiences, the record of their experiences as they remember them, the record of others' experiences as they've been written down. They all come from men. So the real question, I suppose, when we say, what can one believe, is really, whom can one believe? Whom are we to believe? Everybody's got to believe someone. And I suspect that, as was said last night, the most urgent question of our time is, whom are we to believe today? Who am I to believe in my life, my work, my business, my family, my relationships? Whom are we to believe and to follow as a people? Who has remedies, or where are their text solutions that apply to these problems? Well, we haven't obviously found them, have we? We've tried everything under the sun. Maybe it's time for us to ask, what are God's remedies for these problems? And I want to suggest a couple this morning that come out of our scriptures that may give us some guidance. One is from a story in the second chapter of John. There was a wedding in Cana. And Jesus and his mother and his disciples were invited guests, and something went wrong. Somebody had slipped up on what was regarded as a key essential to an occasion like that. They ran out of wine. Now, Jesus' mother, aware of the housekeeping items, as women have a way of doing, reported the difficulty to her son. She said, they have no more wine. And she turned to the servants and said, whatsoever he saith to you, do it. Now that's the one that I want to follow this morning. That's the text. And I want to try to develop it. Not in one of the usual way of developing a text, by exposition. There's another way, and that's by emphasis. Whatsoever he saith unto you. Now, oftentimes what he says to us is very different from what we expect him to say, or what we want him to say, or what we want to hear or believe. And here I'd like to recall another story. This is from the 5th chapter of Luke. You read, it came to pass that as the people pressed upon him to hear the word of God, they didn't just go to see him. They wanted to hear what it is this man was saying, which had some authority, self-evidencing validity. And he stood by the lake of Gennesaret and saw two ships standing by the lake, but the fishermen were gone out of them and were washing their nets. And he entered into one of the ships, which was Simon's, and prayed him that he would thrust out a little from the land. And he sat down and taught the people out of the ship. And when he had left speaking, he said unto Simon, launch out into the deep and let down your nets for a draught. And Simon answered and said, why, master, we've toiled all the night and have taken nothing. What Jesus told him was so different from what he had a right to expect. It was against his own experience, his lifelong experience. It was against his own better judgment. It was against his all common sense. It was impractical. They'd been toiling all night. This wasn't the night for fishing. And so let's mend the nets. And besides, this Jesus is a carpenter. What does he know about fishing? That's our business. And yet, he said, let down the nets for a draft. Furthermore, if Peter were to do that, what would his fellow fishermen say? What's gone wrong with that nut friend of ours? Going off and letting down a draft, or he's been fishing all night. How do you stand up before the ridicule of your friends or your fellow bankers or doctors or teachers or preachers? And he might have said, well, let me slip around at light night, like Nicodemus, when nobody's looking, and let down the nets and see if I get anything. Or let somebody else do it first and see if it works, and then we'll decide. Whatsoever. Whatsoever he saith unto you. So Jesus' mother said, well, what does he say to you and me? He said, launch out into the deep. That's what he says to you and me today. And let down your nets for a catch. Keep my commandments. And what are some of them? Well, one of the things I think he says to us today is personal. Be ye therefore perfect. That is, let me have my way in your life. There are unoccupied areas in your life and in mine. Let me claim those now. Launch out into the deep. It may look senseless, useless, even foolish. Whatsoever. And then another thing that he says to us this morning, I'm sure, is social. Love ye one another. That is, live your lives not primarily in terms of get, but primarily in terms of giving. Get in order to give. Not for self first, but for others, the total. There are unoccupied fields in your interests and attachments, aren't there? Claim them now, Jesus has said. Turn them over to me. There are various races, various classes, all kinds of persons in your community, in your business, in your political associations, in our world. Love them. Not sentimentally. I think it's too bad that love today is generally looked upon sentiment, sort of gushy sentimentality. I heard a minister or a teacher long years ago say, give a definition for love, which I've always stayed with me. He says, it's this kind of love is invincible goodwill. Invincible. Though I disagree with it, it's distasteful to me, I think it's wrong, this, that, and the other, but nothing the person can do can make me hate him. Not sentimentally, I don't like him, but I have invincible goodwill. Now that's an act of will. That's an act of decision. Love them in the sense of total and invincible goodwill. Wishing the best for them. Even when you have to oppose, and oppose without hesitation or without wavering what they are advocating or what they are doing. I think probably another thing that he says to us today, you might call as a missionary. Go. It's a call for action. Go you into all the world. Look at the things around you that are wrong and tackle them. Throw your influence against them now. The kingdom can come only through people who see all the difficulties. Don't duck them. Look them right straight in the face and glory in them with a deathless loyalty. Whatsoever. Well, Peter faced a crisis that day, didn't he? When Jesus told him to let down the net, he could have said, what's the use? No fishing's no good today. And you and I face a crisis when we confront this kind of call from him. Will we obey? Peter said, we've toiled all the night and taken nothing. Nevertheless, at thy word, we will let down the net. That's the key. Will you and I obey whatsoever? We can say, Master, you said unto us, be perfect, and we've tried, sincerely tried, again and again, and it's apparently no use. When the testing comes, I don't live up to what I committed myself to. We backslide, if you wish. We postpone. We rationalize. We've toiled all the night to be the kind of persons you've called us to be, and we want to be. And we haven't achieved victory over ourselves. Nevertheless, at thy word, I will let down the net. Or we could say, Master, you've said to us, love ye one another. And we've tried to do that, and it's just plain too hard. The people aren't lovable. We've honestly tried to crucify self, to serve others rather than self. But always when it comes to the showdown, we fold or we turn back. We've toiled all the night and taken nothing. How can you really love one another? The unlovable. And you've said to us, Master, go ye into all the world. And we've tried that all these years in our own communities, and they're not Christian. There's more crime and delinquency than ever before. We've sent missionaries all over the world to all lands. All these decades, we've given billions, taken insults, been patient, and the world looks darker today than when we began. We've toiled all the night and taken nothing. Nevertheless, at thy will, we will let down the net. And you recall, Peter obeyed. He let him down, and something happened. And he got a jolt when he did whatsoever. When you confront Jesus, you have a jolt. You may think you're a pretty fair cellist until you listen to the master cellist. You may think you're a pretty good painter until one day you stand and look at the master painting. You may think you're a pretty good surgeon until one day you stand in the operating room alongside the master surgeon and it isn't good enough what you're doing. And you may have been living a pretty good life, and we're not going to jail. We aren't committing any crimes. We're respectable. But we stand one day, as Peter did that day, in the presence of the master, and our lives aren't good enough. And like Peter, our first impulse is to be overwhelmed by our own weaknesses and to confess them. He fell on his knees right there in the bottom of the boat, and he says, depart from me, O Lord, for I'm a sinful man. I can't make anything out of this. He confessed. He listened first. He obeyed. Miracle happened. And then he saw himself in his true light. And he confessed. Are we prepared to do that? Whatsoever he saith unto us, do it. Now the second word in that emphasis is he. Whatsoever he saith unto us. Oh my, look at the voices we have today. This commentator and that columnist, this congressman, that senator, this clergyman and this professor, and the rich and the poor, and the employers and the employees, and the white and the black, and the Republicans and the Democrats and the independents and the anarchists and the revolutionists, the practical and the sentimental, the doubters, the faithless, the cynical. All of the voices that crowd in on us, the answer to that is whatsoever he saith unto us. In the midst of all the discouragements and the frustrations, haven't we sincerely tried? Yes. In the midst of the doubts, it doesn't look sensible. In the midst of the divisions with our own country, lo here, lo there. Everybody's got something else. What does he say? That's the word for us, I think. Now the third emphasis I'd put out is this. Whatsoever he saith unto you. How do you find out what he's saying? You don't want a surgeon to operate on you who's only been studying 6 months. We were talking at breakfast this morning about this very point. Mr. Shepherdson was talking about the times people come in before the Federal Reserve Board and they got a neat little solution and a lot of tables and that'll solve the problem. You just can't buy an understanding of so complicated situations as we have here at home and abroad as cheaply as we'd like. I took a long time yesterday to get through the introduction of some of these problems. You just can't get it in one weekend. What does he say? Well, how does he speak to us? He speaks to us first through the scriptures. And how much have we studied the scriptures? How much do we study the scriptures today? The record of what he said in person in his generation. He speaks through his words, and he speaks through his teachings, and he speaks through his parables, and he speaks through his deeds. The story of his life, how he met trials and suffering, and how he met triumph, and how he met and rejoiced in gladness and satisfactions, how he met temptations, how he met loneliness, how he met the needs of others. It's there. I'm a kind of high-tension guy, and one time when I was a young fella, a man said to me, young man, he said, you must learn to spend more time in the presence of that man who never was in a hurry, even though his task was to overcome the whole world in 3 short years. How do we expect to know what he's saying if we don't study what he says? There's another little side issue that helped me an awful lot. When I went out as a missionary, and my technique, my training, my, the way of witnessing my love for people was through my specialized work as a physician and surgeon. And yet I had a sense of guilt that I wasn't proclaiming the gospel, that I wasn't preaching, wasn't preaching more. And one day I got an answer to it in the story of the disciples on the way to Emmaus. After the resurrection, they were running out. The show was over, collapsed. Great dream, it was a bust. And they were talking about it, and a man came along. They didn't recognize him. He was dead, wasn't he? They saw him buried. He couldn't be alive. Never under the head, he was alive. It was over. And they were talking about it. And he said, what are you talking about? And he said, well, they said, don't you know? You've been around here and don't know all these things happen in Jerusalem these days? This is the little gem of a text that says something to you. A prophet, mighty in what? No, that isn't what it says. That's what we always say. He mighty in deed and word. That's the order. All my life up till the moment I saw that, we've always said mighty in word and deed. The word and then our deeds have got to come up to our words, but hasn't the way. Mighty in deed. What's the word? The word's merely the explanation of the deed. The whole New Testament is merely explanation of a deed. God so loved the world that he sent his son into the world. He intervened in history. That's the deed. And I got released. My job was to show my love. And then I had much more satisfaction and usefulness as a missionary. And I found out oftentimes when a patient was about ready to go home, making the last rounds, not infrequently, you'd be surprised how often they'd say diffidently, well, you know, I never was in a hospital before. And I never had any contact with foreigners before. And I don't quite understand this place, this Christian hospital. Why, you got girls who come in and minister to us, Chinese girl, as well as a couple of Minnesota girls in that hospital. He said, "Why, these are things we don't do. Chinese don't even touch each other out of courtesy." We say, he wouldn't shake hands with a fellow. That's an insult from our point of view. From their point of view, it's an insult to stick out your hand and intrude on the other fellow's privacy. Maybe he'd prefer not to take hold of your clammy hand. So he shakes hands this way, or in South Asia this way. Sensitive to the other man's personal wishes. So he'd say, "You folks come and ministers, you're not making any money out of this. My goodness, look what little I'm getting. You've got this big establishment here, 150 people working in it. You can't finance this. What do you do this for?" Now there's the point. You see, the deed. Now he wants the explanation. Oftentimes he'll say, "Don't you have a father and mother?" "Yes." "Where are they?" "Well, they're in the United States where I come from." "Well, you know, we Chinese, we always like to have our children around us, especially our sons." "Don't you have a wife?" "Yes." "Do you have any children?" "Yes." "Where are they?" "Well, they went back because of the troubles that are here. I sent them out." "Well, we like to have them close. Wouldn't your father and mother like to have you closer at home?" "Yes." "Wouldn't your wife like to have you home with children?" "Yes." "Well, then you see, what are you doing here?" And I can tell him in 1 minute why I'm there. And then the hospital evangelist comes along. He's with the team, and he gets and takes it further along and leads him. But the basic decision's made on the basis of somebody's deed. Oh, if we'd study this book, study it and open our minds to him. As I said last night, Jesus was so practical. And until I got into politics, really, I thought he was a kind of a sentimentalist off here with fine statements, but not real know-how as to timing and to practical, when to hit and when to withdraw, when to specialize and shoot with a rifle and not try to take on all the things at one time with a shotgun and miss them in effect and not be effective in any of them. He also speaks through the lives and experiences of others. He talks to us through history, biography of the saints and the seers and the sinners all the way down through the centuries. He speaks to us through them. He speaks to us through the counsel of our friends who know us oftentimes better than we know ourselves, and they love us. And do we listen to their counsel? Among friends at an unusual opportunity such as you have at a conference like this, he speaks to us directly through prayer. And to me, prayer is not abdicating my mental processes and sit there vacant, hoping, "Please write something on this blank sheet of paper." Some people seem to have that kind of a receiving set. I don't. With me, it's thinking in the presence of God. There's music in this room here this morning. I don't hear it. I didn't follow the music. I just don't happen right now to have the receiving set tuned in to that music. So he's talking to us all the time, and a lot of the time we're just not tuned in. But do you have to have some kind of audible voice? Norman Vincent Peale's one of my dear friends, and he publishes this little booklet, Guideposts. I've talked to him a time or two, but I kind of regret it that so many of the articles are all about the people who heard a voice, because most of us don't hear voices, and we feel there's something wrong with us because we don't. I remember when I decided to go as a missionary to China, one of my friends said to me, a doctor friend, he said, "What are you going to China for?" Well, I tried to explain it to him, and he said, "Well, did you have a call like St. Paul?" And I said, "No." You could see he thought I hadn't any business going to China as a Christian if I didn't have a call like St. Paul. But I said, that doesn't disturb me, that I haven't had a miraculous call like St. Paul, because first place, I never expected God to use a million-dollar method like that on a $15 man. So I wasn't upset by that. And the second thing is, I want to ask you a question. Have you had a call to stay at home? You're a Christian. What business are you getting settled down here in Omaha where we were practicing to be comfortable unless God gave you a vision in the middle of the night and says, "I want you here in Omaha"? Do you have a miraculous call? Now, what sent me? What was my call? It was a formula. Where the need is the greatest, that there's a reasonable probability that I can meet. If it's a need for musicians and I can't carry a tune, that's not a need for me. But if it's a need that I can meet, where the needs are the greatest and the workers are the fewest, that was my call. This was during World War I, and we had a draft up. Uncle Sam didn't have to convince us we should go. It was up to us to convince him we shouldn't go, wasn't it? Well, I didn't have any physical defect, so I couldn't get out on that. And I didn't have any special gifts or talents that made me essential at the home front. I couldn't pretend that. And I was a young student. I didn't have any, going to medical school then. I didn't have any dependents. There was no reason I could go. I tried to convince the Lord that I shouldn't go, but I couldn't do it. I didn't have any call to stay at home, and therefore the need sent me out. My mind. He didn't give me this mind and ask me to put it in cold storage. If I went out to pick apples, and here are two orchards and a little creek in between them. That's the ocean. One fellow picking apples in this orchard and 60 fellows picking apples in that orchard, same size orchard. Where should I go? I have to have a special call to go where there's only one? No, I'd need a special call to crowd in where there are already 60. The facts talked to me, told me what I should do, unless he stopped me. He didn't stop me. And that's the way he spoke to me. When I put my mind at rest, or try to put it at rest, in touch with God, I have discovered it thinks more clearly, with fewer rationalizations. Its decisions have proved through the years sounder. And when it doesn't come through fairly easily, I always get a sheet of paper, and I draw a line down through the center of it. Sometimes a lot of them I take two sheets. On one of them, I put all the reasons why I should. On the other, all the reasons why I shouldn't. Look at them. Usually it's very clear. When I write them all down, okay, I said, Lord, I didn't want this, but there the preponderance is greater. So, kid, I'm going to do it unless you stop it. Stop me. Now, this isn't the way we usually do. We say, Lord, you make the decision and submit it to me, and I'll decide whether to do or not. But that isn't the way it happens. He says in John 7:17, he that willeth to do will know. It's not his job to submit the decision to me for my approval. What would he do to me if he did that? He'd convert me into a Charlie McCarthy, just saying what Edgar Bergen put in his mouth. This would be downgrading me as a person. How do I learn to come to decisions except by coming to decisions? But when I say, this I will do, when it's clear this is what I will do, then I find out. It's up to me to make the decision and submit it to him for his approval or disapproval. It's surprising how often that comes. When I write it all down, it's clear I should or should not do. And I say, okay, here it is. Usually there comes one or the other, all very quickly, a feeling of relief. Well, gee, I finally... And I say, I got the approval. Other times, from the very beginning, I just don't feel right about it. And I get out another sheet of paper, black ones, blank ones, and start all over again. Whatsoever he saith to you, whatsoever he saith to you, by all the methods that are available. Now the next word, whatsoever he saith to you, not to somebody else. What does he say to you? What does he say to me? I attended a meeting of young Christians, one of these people where we let down our meetings, where we let down our hair and so on. And there was a young woman there, and I'll bet 10 times in the morning meeting, she said, but you must be born again, you must be born again, you must be born again. She'd had a great experience, her face was radiant, and everybody had to have the same experience as she had right now. The Lord had said that to her, she didn't give the Lord a chance to reveal himself to the others directly. He had to do it again. Finally, one of the men said, now, you've said that 6 or 8 times here before lunch. During the lunch hour, would you read the scriptures and come back and tell us in the afternoon how many times Jesus said that and to whom? This is your answer for everybody, right now. Well, how many times did he give that is his answer? She came back and said, well, I can only find one. Who was it? Nicodemus. Why do you suppose he said that to Nicodemus? Well, because that was the thing Nicodemus needed most. He was a correct man. He hadn't committed any crime. He was not in sex or drugs or thievery or treason or anything else. His life was completely faultless. Nobody could find anything wrong with him, except his pride in his faultless. He had to begin by being born again. But Jesus didn't say that to the rich young ruler. The center of his life was not pride, but possessions. And he said to him, go and sell and give. He didn't say that to the fisherman. He said, let down your nets for a draft. He said to one woman taken in adultery, go and sin no more. He said to another bad woman, please, will you draw a cup of water and give me to drink? To every person, he approached him in terms of that person's particular need. Now, don't misunderstand me. I'll take second place to nobody in the world in my belief in the need of a rebirth. But to begin always where I have arrived is arrogance and not Christian sensitivity. One time, my brother and I got into an argument. He said something about my mother, or I said, I guess, and he jumped on me in a friendly way. We were brothers, and he said, why, mother's not like that. Why, sure, she's like that. And so we had an argument, and then we laughed. You see, he was a totally different person from me. My mother could reveal one part. She revealed them all, but he perceived, he responded to one aspect of her character, and I to another. She was what he saw. She was also what I saw. And my guess is Dad saw a few other things in her that we, neither of us, saw. She was more than just my understanding. And that's the same with God. And I get a hold of this, and it's right, and everybody's got to take mine. I demand you begin where I've arrived. You can't. If you say you believe that, you're lying. You can't believe it. You can come to believe it only if you try it out and it works. You can begin in faith, but conviction comes only after you've tried it and it works. Instead of approaching people and saying, won't you follow? Let God take care of the result. No two of us will have exactly the same description of Jesus. One of my daughters came home from college, and she said, Dad, I don't want to hurt you and Mother, but I can't believe some of the things we've been taught here at home and in the Sunday school and so on. I said, why not? And she said, well, I got a young professor, turned out to be 26, 7 years old, a great guy, but he hadn't had much experience yet. And he wasn't sure of himself, and like so always, if you aren't sure, you always want to pull everybody else down to your level. Then you don't have any qualms of conscience if everybody else is doing it. She said, he's shown us that we can't believe something that we can't prove, and we can't prove these are true. Well, I said to her, if you can't have a belief without proof, can you have a disbelief without proof? Well, you go back and ask him if he can prove they aren't so. And if he can't prove they aren't so, and he can't, I didn't say that, then let's you and I make a bargain. Don't suddenly doubt all your beliefs, just doubt half of them. And don't suddenly believe all your doubts, just believe half of them. While you work at it for a while and try to see how it comes out. And might I make a couple of suggestions as your father? Yes. Well, one of them is this. You know your father was trained as a general surgeon. If you get something wrong in your tummy, do you call the eye doctor? You call the toe doctor? You call the brain doctor if the trouble's down here? No, you call the person who's a specialist there. Well, now, if you want to know something about religion, who do you call? The guy who just scorns it? Does he know most about it? Who knows most about what happens or doesn't happen in prayer? The fellow who's never prayed, or the man who's been prayed? What's his testimony? Go after the experts in this field, the one who've been after it, my daughter. Pay attention to what they say. Don't believe it abjectly, but test out what they have said. And may I make a further inquiry, because I knew she'd taken a course in chemistry. I said, she said, sure. I said, well, you took a course in chemistry. What did you do first? She said, well, I bought a book. One book? No, two books. I majored in chemistry. I knew something about that. What were the books? Well, one told us all about general chemistry, and the other was the laboratory manual. Oh, laboratory manual. What did you do? I had one of those, went at the laboratory, and it said, take 10 grams of this and dissolve it in 500 cc of that, and heat it up to such and such a temperature, and add 15 cc of this reagent, you'll get a precipitate. And then you filter that out and desiccate it and redissolve it in another solvent, and you'll get so and so. Do you have that kind of thing to do? Yes. Did you do it? Yes. Why? Did you know it would work? No. Did you know you'd get that precipitate? And that it would dissolve? No. Why did you do it? You couldn't do it when you couldn't prove it. Well, she got the point. She grinned and she said, I suppose I figured the guy who wrote the book knew what he was talking about. That's the point. That's the whole point. She didn't know. She began faith in the man who wrote the textbook. He'd been over this road. And this was his record. But she didn't know. I said, suppose it says, take 5 cc, 10 grams of this and dissolve it in 500 cc and heat it up and add the reagent and get the precipitate and now redissolve it. And you say, that doesn't make sense. I just precipitated it out. What do I want to redissolve it for? I'll skip that. And that doesn't make sense. And then you don't get the result. Then you throw the book out the window because you didn't get the results when you didn't follow the instruction. Now, if you follow the instructions and you get the result, then you know. Then it's not faith. Then you know. This young woman was right. He must be born again. But she was driving people away because she was demanding that they begin with her conviction as a result of her experience. Whatsoever he saith to you, and it'll be different to every single person. We're individualized. You don't have trouble treating your children different. Sometimes you wonder how the same man and woman can have three or four such totally different young creatures. They're not equal, are they? One's more gifted than the other. How are they equal? They're equal in your sight. They're equally precious. When it said, I said yesterday, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created, the next one that they're created equal. Equal in ability? Why, of course not. Not two of them in ability. No two of them with the same fingerprints. How are they equal? They're equal in God's sight. As your kids are equally precious. And one, if one is a little less gifted than the other, you tend to shower a little extra care, attention, to the one who needs it more. Equally precious. That's why you've got good governments got to have laws under which they're all equal. Not one set of laws for the rich, another for the poor, and one for the black, and another for the white. All equal under the law. They'll not get the same results. They won't have equal results. Equalization of opportunity. Most challenging thing ever turned loose in history. Equalization of results, the most paralyzing. Why in the world should you do your best if the result would be no better than if you didn't do your best? Study. Study. Whatsoever he saith unto you. Now the next one. Whatsoever he saith unto you, do it. Not just read and study and write a paper or discuss or even pray about it. There comes a point where you do it. You take the question of marriage. So many of our people seem to think marriage is a matter of the mind and a matter of the heart. It isn't. A marriage is entered not when you love that girl. She's the greatest. That's in your heart. And when you admire her and you think she's gifted, she'll be a good mother for children, she'll be a good wife, she's got good qualities, your mind tells you it's right. But you're married. One day you stand in front of the altar and say, I do. That's an act of the will. I committed myself. Period. Whatsoever he saith unto you, do it. Do it. It was when Peter obeyed that his failures, all night they'd toiled and caught nothing and went out. Nevertheless, at thy will, I will let down the net. And they got such a draft that the nets were broken. And Peter fell down and said, Lord, depart from me. He confessed, I'm not adequate. And what did Jesus say? I'm going to make you fishers of men. Now I can do something with you. Couldn't do anything before. Long as you thought you knew all about fishing, there was no hope. Now you haven't so sure. Now I can do something with you. I'm going to make you fishers of men. And they left their nets and followed him. Do it. It's when we obey that our defeats, and who doesn't have them, can be turned into victory. Then we know. Now one more. Whatsoever he saith unto you, do it. Not something else. It. And this is what so often we don't do. We do part of it. How many read where Jesus said, "Come unto me, all ye that labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest." And we say, "Wonderful, Y-E, that means me." And we sit down and rest. And rest. And rest. Then we turn over a few pages and we read where it says, "Go into all the world and make this available to every creature." Y-E, as near as I can see, it's spelled the same way. But that isn't me. So we turn over the next page. That must be a misprint. You see, we pick out the ones that please us. No, whatsoever he saith unto you, do it. And even that text, we don't read that, but the first half. It says, doesn't say, "Come unto me, all ye that have been laboring, and I'll give you rest. You won't have to work anymore." You read it, it's in the present tense. "Come unto me, all you that are laboring, and I will give you rest." Not rest from labor. Still got it. Do the work. But rest in labor. You won't be broken by it. You can handle it if you come unto him. In the midst of your labor, do it. However unexpected, however unsuitable, however unreasonable, however against common sense, tradition, my desires, how different from anything we've ever done before, how unrelevant it may seem to be to our positions, however beyond our capacities and our resources, we haven't got the resources for them. Whatsoever he saith unto you, do it. Now each of us is following someone's advice. You're believing somebody. Whose advice are you following? Each of us believes someone. Whom are we going to believe? Whatsoever for me meant to go to China. And I expected to spend all my life there. But some things happened. I got malaria, and the bandits and communists came in, closed our down, and I was brought home. And then they said I never could go back, so I felt I needed more training. I went to the Mayo Clinic, got a fellowship in surgery and got the training. Got over the malaria, married, better home, family life, food, no reinfections. And there was a very urgent need in North China, where they're so dry there are no mosquitoes, and therefore no malaria. And I resigned and went out there. And then the Japanese came in. I was under them for 5 months until I was able to get out. That's another long story I won't bother with. Another hospital closed down. Second hospital shot out from under me. And I came back to the United States and tried my best for 2 years, a little over, to get us to stop building up our enemies, because that was going to lead to war. Same as I'm trying to get us now, not to build up our enemies. Please don't help the Chinese communists impose their will on 750 million people. That isn't the way to make them lose. That isn't the way to help the people of China get their freedom. Gentlemen, there isn't going to be any real peace or stability until the Chinese people are free and able to participate in the world through a government that represents them. And this ultimate Peking represents nobody but itself. It's totally un-Chinese. Mao Zedong sends out the Red Guards to destroy the four olds. Old ideas, old customs, old culture, old habits. Everything Chinese must be eliminated, washed out of their minds. So help them win? No. It's because we want the Chinese people to be in the world community that you mustn't recognize that self-selected, self-imposed, self-perpetuating dictatorship, which is depriving them of a chance to make their very constructive contribution. People say they're there, therefore we should recognize. No, no, no. There are gangsters in Chicago, but you don't say they're afraid to bring them into the police force since they're there. Don't help the adversary win patiently and with invincible goodwill. Stand on the side of the oppressed. So my work was closed, and I came home and tried to do this in a larger sense. And Pearl Harbor came, and people said, "Well, for goodness sake, that's just what that guy was telling us, and we ought to have more people in Washington who had some first-hand experience." The last thing on earth I ever expected to do was be in public life. I never had one course in public speaking, never dreamed. All my work was in science. If I'd have said, "Now, Lord, you got to show me my whole life before I start," I don't know where I'd have got, but it was clear I ought to go to China. That door closed, another door opened. That door closed, another door opened. That door closed, another door opened. And then I got into public life and perhaps had some opportunity to witness larger opportunity than I would otherwise have had, and then that door closed. That's not too bad. There are other opportunities. as you start back to Denver after dark. How do you start? You can't see Denver. But you can see a half a mile up the road, and you follow your light that half mile. And when you get there, the headlights will be out the next half mile. You take it step by step by step. You can't lay down the law to the Lord what the final is going to be at this time. Whatsoever he saith unto you right now, do it. Now, I hope you'll forgive me for talking about this in considerable earnestness this morning, because I think that there isn't anything more important for you or for me today in this kind of torn, distraught, troubled world than what Mary said to the servants when those people were in a jam. Whatsoever he saith unto you, do it. Whom shall we believe? Well, some of the disciples turned back, and Jesus said to those closest one, will you also turn away? And they replied, to whom shall we go? Who else has the word of life for us today? Or for our country? Or for our torn world? I heard him call. There's a poem like that. I heard him call. Come follow. That was all. My goal grew dim. My soul rose after him. Who could but follow if he heard him call? Now, one very short little scripture. It's one thing to make a decision. It's another thing to carry through. Create in me a clean heart, O God. And I make up my mind at a conference like this, but I get home and the other people weren't here, and I begin to think maybe I got swept off my feet. Create a clean heart, yeah. But renew. Here's where I fall down. Renew. Daily renew a right spirit. There's a crisis and there's a process. And more of us fail, we as Christians, I think, in the process than in the crisis. And the thing that helped me when I became a Christian, I had to completely do a 180-degree reversal, I pasted up on the window of my mirror the first 8 verses of the 15th chapter of John. And when I was shaven, I'd go down through the list. Every day, not just once in a while. Every day, the way the alcoholics have to pray, Lord, help me be sober till noon. And then let me be sober till night. And please keep me through this evening till I'm sober. Don't ask me sober for the next year, just the rest of this day. It's the 15th chapter where Jesus said, I am the true vine, and my Father is the husbandman. I'm not the husbandman. My Father is the husbandman. Every branch in me that, what? Doesn't give good shade? No. Every branch that doesn't break the wind gives shelter for the person. Every branch that isn't beautiful to look at and please the eye? No. Every branch in me that beareth not fruit, Jesus is talking about himself, he taketh away. And every branch that beareth fruit, does he give you a reride? No, he pruneth it. He tightens up on it. And he's stricter and tougher with you and me who are trying our best than others. I had a surgeon he used to jump on me something awful. And I said to him one day, I prayed I'd just as well quit because I don't seem to be satisfying. He said, well, if I didn't think you had some possibilities, I wouldn't make all this effort trying to make something out of you. Every branch that beareth fruit, he pruneth it. There's some hope in you that it may bear fruit, more fruit. The next one. Now ye are clean. Stood up from the last one. But boy, you'll probably fall down again. Now ye are clean how? Through the word which I have spoken unto you. How do you keep clean? Abide in me and I in you. As the branch cannot bear fruit except it abide in the vine, no more can you. What makes you think you can? What makes you think you can bear fruit without him? I like that word, abide. We rush in and out. Lord, I've got up late this morning and I haven't got time, and I've got some other things I got to attend to. And that's better than nothing, but his word was, if you abide in me, stay in it till you get into his presence. If you abide in me, now you're clean through the word which I have spoken unto you. Abide in me, and I in you, as the branch cannot bear fruit You never yet saw a branch that was bearing fruit cut off from the vine. Not one. As the branch cannot bear fruit except it abide in the vine. I just will go back to bed. No use even finishing the shaving if I'm not in his presence, because there won't anything happen today. Through me. No, as the branch cannot bear fruit except it abide in the vine, no more can you, except ye abide in me. I am the vine, he then said, and you are the branches. He moves on from him being the vine, and he was the vine, and his father was the husband. Now he is the vine, and we are the branches. He that abideth in me, and I in him, the same, nobody else, the same bringeth forth much fruit, for without me ye can do nothing. The beginning of wisdom for a Christian is to recognize that without him, we aren't going to make it. We can't do it in our own strength, but we're not called upon to do it in our strength. And he went ahead in the sixth verse and makes it even stronger. He said, if a branch abides not in me, it is cast forth. If a man abide not in me, he is cast forth as a branch and is withered, and men gather them into piles and burn them. And then this glorious seventh verse, if ye abide in me, and my words abide in you, ye shall ask what ye will, and it shall be done unto you. And I think it was 10 years of reading this before I quite believed that. I didn't quite see it. It's too big, too extravagant. Ye can ask what ye will, and it shall be done unto you. And finally, one day I discovered that I was paying no attention to the condition. If ye abide in me, and my words abide in you. I become so closely identified with him that there isn't anything I want except what he wants. You see? And all I ask will be in harmony with his will, and it'll be done unto him, done unto me. And the eighth says, herein is my Father glorified. What? That ye bear much fruit. So shall ye be my disciples. God bless you.